I'll call to order the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee. We do not have a, well, actually, we do have a quorum now. Representative Pinto is walking in. First of all, let's move the minutes from January 20th, 2015. Is there a motion to move the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Johnson moves the minutes. Any discussion, corrections? Seeing none, everyone in favor of approving the minutes of January 20th, 2015, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. The first item on our, or the first bill on our agenda today, actually we're going to reverse order here a little bit. I know that Representative Anderson has a testifier that's come quite a distance, and so we want to be able to honor that. And so if Representative Anderson would come forward to the testifiers table. And do I have Representative Johnson, would you like to move House File 253? Oh, that one's wrong. 239, please. Thank you. Actually, we do have, let's back up 1 minute. First of all, I think there's an amendment to the bill. So, Representative Johnson, would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
I will move the DE1 amendment.
Thank you. Any discussion on that amendment, folks? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The DE1 is adopted. Now, Representative Johnson, would you like to move House File 239?
I'll move House File 239.
Thank you. And Representative Anderson, go ahead and proceed with the bill and your testifier.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for allowing us the luxury of coming in early. My testifier comes from back in the district, so we appreciate the haste you can get us up to us. So thank you much. And just a quick note on the reason for the amendment. It doesn't change the bill at all. It simply moves it to a different part of the statute, which was deemed to be more appropriate for this bill. So what the amendment does is just move the bill to a different area of statute. This topic was brought to me by Mr. Ritter, whom you'll hear from here in just a second. And we're not trying to make major changes in things, just to avoid some wasteful spending in the areas that we'll talk about, conservatorship, assets and such. And the requirement in a new law, I think, that went into effect back in 2009 about having them post a bonding amount of money to continue doing these things. And we feel in a lot of situations that is a high cost of money for some of these folks, and would like to give the courts, judges, some discretion in how they would set bond amounts and things like that. So that's what this bill does, Madam Chair. And with that, I'll let my testifier explain the reasoning behind the bill.
Thank you for coming to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the table.
Madam Chair, Dennis Ritter from Melrose, Minnesota. My sister and I are guardians over a sister who's 63 years old. My mother, when she was born, had Rh factor, and he didn't get her blood change in time. So her main problem is speech impediment and a little bit of walking, but as far as her mind goes and brain, it's excellent. The problem we run into is 26 years ago, my dad appointed my sister and I as guardians over her in case something ever happened to our folks. So each year we do an annual notice renewal petition to the county of all her net worth statements, all her doctor bills are combined, everything's accounted for. There's nothing that can be scratched out. If she writes me a check out for picking up clothes up town for whatever it might be, it's accounted for. We spend between $600 and $700 each year on this audit. So this year I got a letter in the mail in October stating that, and right now her net worth is $259,000. So we got a letter in the mail stating that she needed to be bonded for 1% of her net worth, which would be $2,590 per year. And so we petitioned it to the Stearns County Court December 26th in front of Judge Cashman. And after hearing it, he reduced it down to $50,000. So we end up being bonded all for $50,000. And his comment as he left the courtroom with us, he says, I hope you people can get this law changed because it's making a lot of judges happy. And one of my comments to my sister the other day is when she seen me, right now I've got over $1,000 in attorney fees just to appeal this thing plus the bonding of it. And she said, let my money alone is her comment, you know. So that's my side of the story.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions among members? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have been the author of the bonding requirement in 2009. I don't quite recall, but In my day job, I prosecute folks who financially exploit vulnerable adults. And so my question is, if you don't have a bond in place, what other option does the court have in the event that someone is behaving inappropriately? They won't have the bond to dip into to replace those funds.
Madam, I can see where you're coming from. There should probably be two different situations because we already count her for everything we do with her. And she writes her own checks to begin with and does her own checkbook and everything. And I know where you're coming from, that bill, and I respect that part of it, but when we're in this situation where we're already reporting a petition to the county for 26 years, we have a track record and everything's accounted for, I see no reason why we should be bonded on this part of it, because her assets are protected by the county watching us.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure then that this is structured very narrowly so that it
right.
gets cases like yours and not all of the cases, because of course we've seen that that's been a growing area of crime in our.
Madam, I agree with you on that, but
Mr. Ritter.
I think it should be two parts to the rule or the law, whatever that would allow for this. In a case like this, we've worked with an attorney who does all our work for us in Melrose to begin with, everything, you know. So the court petitions us in the fall to send us a renewal notice, and we do it, and they send it back saying it's been approved.
Representative Anderson, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, thank you, and good questions, Representative. And the current law says you need to bond at least to $10,000. This wouldn't change that. So in this case, some of the assets are going to be put away, so to speak, so they can't be touched. So to lower that amount of bondable money down to in that $10,000 to $50,000 range, to just lower the cost of that bond requirement is what we're trying to accomplish here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And does this go to any other committee, or is it going straight to the floor from here?
Representative Hillstrom, it is going to, Public Safety and Crime Prevention Judiciary Committee.
So. Thanks. I'll see it there as well, so between now and then I'll make sure that I look at it further. Thank you.
And I would enjoy, Madam Chair, working with you to try to come up with some narrower language that would address your concerns as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions among members? Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 239 be passed as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Crime Prevention, and Judiciary. Is there all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The bill is passed. Thank you, Mr. Ritter and Representative Anderson.
Thank you for letting me testify. Yeah.
Thank you. The next bill up is House File 262, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative
Smith. In appreciation of the long-standing tradition of freshmen introducing the first bill that they treat for the committee and staff,
All right. We train our freshmen well here. Yes, we do. Thank you, Representative Smith. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Smith, would you, I believe you have an amendment to your bill. Is that correct?
I do, yes. I move that amendment A1 be added to the bill.
Okay. Discussion on the amendment. Representative Smith, would you like to explain a little bit about what the A1 does?
Yes, the amendment clarifies and matches up language from the Senate file of bill.
Okay, great. Representative Johnson, do you have a question on the A1?
I do not.
Okay. All those in favor of adopting the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
I would. I'd like to move that bill number 262 be moved.
All right. Go ahead and proceed with your presentation of your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. This bill comes from the Minnesota State Bar Association, and it deals with a couple areas of real estate law, specifically the abstract area and the torrents of both systems. The first part deals with the definition and approval for landowner plats, and the second piece deals with the cancellation of contract for deeds, specifically in the Torrens property system. And I would like, I brought Mr. Dunleavy, who's a member of the real property section of the Minnesota State Bar, to give additional testimony.
Thank you. Representative, or excuse me, Mr. Dunleavy, go ahead and present your testimony after
Madam Chair, I'm Kevin Dunleavy, and I represent, or I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And we put this bill together. There's two parts. Section 1 deals with plat approval, and plats, all real estate starts out with government survey description, section, range, and township number. But when areas become more urbanized, they change the legal descriptions to platted legal descriptions, where it would be Lot 1, Block 1, Jones Edition. That makes it easier for local governments to keep track of them for taxes and also for real estate transactions. It's much simpler to use a platted legal description. Plats can be approved by cities, counties, and townships. And under the present law, for plat approval by one of those local governments, the developer has to present an abstract to the local government. Unfortunately, abstracts are becoming obsolete in many parts of the state. I haven't seen an abstract in my practice probably for about 20 years. They're more common in rural areas, but even in rural areas, they're becoming, I think, probably extinct, and eventually will become extinct throughout most of the state. So what this is saying is, local governments don't have to require an abstract, which, if the developer doesn't have one, can be very expensive. They can use alternate methods of title evidence. And the ones that we've chosen here are ones that provide a full chain of title. And the reason that you need that is because you're looking for easements, which might be 50 years old, mortgages on the property because the lender has to consent to the plat, and then who's the fee owner of the plat because they have to dedicate the plat. So this basically what this does is it gives local governments the ability to use other reliable types of title evidence and will save developers costs in the platting process. The second part deals with cancellations of contract or deed. There are a lot of situations where ma and pa sell the farm or the house to the young couple on a contract for deed. But the young couple doesn't pay, and so mom and dad have to cancel the contract. What a lot of them don't know is that with Torrance property, there's another step. They have to go do a petition subsequent. And petitions subsequent cost about $5,000, depending on difficulty of service and things like that. What this does is it says if the cancellation has been recorded for 5 years, then it's not necessary to do a petition subsequent. The owner of the Torrance property can request what's called an examiner's directive, which basically it's a letter to the examiner of titles, and if they think that the cancellation is okay, then they'll take it off the certificate of title. So the purpose here is to make Torrance property more user-friendly in that situation.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Maybe I missed it when the donuts were being passed out, but did you define what Torrance property is, just the distinction between that and other real property?
That's a good question, Madam Chair. All the property in the state starts out as abstract property. In the late 1800s, Sir Richard Robert Torrens from Australia, he worked in a ship's registry office, and he thought, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have to go look at all these dusty documents at the courthouse to figure out what the title is. Let's make real estate like a ship's registry. And the closest thing that most people in the room are probably familiar with would be a certificate of title for a car. And so instead of having to look through all the deeds and mortgages and easements back to the 1860s, you can just look at that certificate of title. You have to go to the court, and the court does a title examination, and if they're satisfied with the title, then they'll issue a certificate of title. Then it becomes registered property or Torrance property. About 40% of the property in Hennepin County is Torrance. Hennepin, Anoka, Ramsey, St. Louis County have the most Torrance property, and then the rest of the counties in the state have lower amounts. And there was about 25 states that had Torrance, and now it's down to about half a dozen or so in the U.S.
And so would this bill make title searches easier and less expensive? I know that's one area when you go to close on a property, there's always a fee for that. Is this going to affect that at all?
This will make transfers of title less expensive in these situations like I described where the cancellation occurred, but they didn't do a petition subsequent. It'll save a significant amount of money in those situations.
Right. Any further discussion from members? Questions? Seeing none, Representative Smith would like to renew his motion to pass House File 262 and have it referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Representative Smith, your bill is passed. Thank you so much again for the wonderful treats. Representative Lesh, are you ready to present your bill? While Representative Lesh is making his way to the table, I was at a chamber event for women business owners recently, and someone from, and I don't remember her exact title, but she's an attorney with the military in some capacity, and we had gotten a discussion about this bill. I was very excited that it was coming to this committee. I think it's a good bill. So Representative Lesh is at the table. We'll let him go ahead and explain the bill and what it does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 260 is called the Uniform Deployed Parents Custody and Visitation Act. Next to me, Major Lindsay Olson with the Minnesota National Guard is going to go into the details of it. But before she does, I'm going to tell you a brief story. In 2009, I went down to Fort Benning for basic training in AIT. It's OSED Combined Infantry Training. And I was in a bay. I slept in a bay for four months. We had a Christmas break in there too, but with 62 other guys. It's infantry, so it was all guys, and the vast majority of them were half my age. And being half my age, they had the opportunity to do many more stupid things before they left for Fort Benning, like get married or something, or you know, have kids or something like that. Well. Inevitably, when you're that young and you're removed from the situation, things go downhill. Now, at basic training, you're not allowed any communication. We didn't even get a phone call. We were supposed to get one phone call at Thanksgiving, but the lines were too long, so half the people didn't get it. So they had to resort to letters back and forth. So over the course of weeks, as basic training started, I could see the letters that they got back from their girlfriends get darker and darker and darker, or their wives. And the two guys in the bunks next to me, around about late October, began the process of sobbing themselves to sleep at night because of how their relationships were going south, and they didn't know what was going to happen to their kids. It was really a sad situation to see. Now, this was, of course, not deployment, but it was similar in that the communication was severely restricted. It was as close to deployment as those kids had seen at that point. I say kids, but you know they were men, they were serving our country, so it's a different situation. I had another soldier in my battalion during the deployment to Kuwait just in 2011 when two of the 135 was deployed to Kuwait, and he had called me in the midst of it because he was going through a divorce. Had no opportunity to see his kid or even communicate with his kid via video, which a lot of other his fellow soldiers were doing. He wanted an option to be able to do that. There was no option provided in the current system and law. Now, it's something that technically a judge could already do, but he found it difficult establishing to the judge that this was important because he was in a different situation as a deployed soldier. So House File 260 is important. And rather than go into the details, which I'll let Major Olson do, I'll describe, first of all, it's a uniform law. So for those of you freshmen that don't understand uniform laws, essentially a lot of other states have passed them through the Uniform Laws Commission, and the vast majority of anything objectionable has already been winnowed out. Some of us think of it as watered down, too. But it's not, they're not nearly as objectionable. Number two, it's a Bar Association bill. The Military and Veterans Affairs section, as well as the Family Law section of the Bar Association, has worked on this and sanded off the edges to make it good law. And number three, as I'd noted previously, technically this is something that vast majority of it the judges can already do. But we do that sometimes around here. We pass laws that even though a judge can already do it, we need to establish some guidelines, because especially in an area as wrought with obstacles as family law, judges will need some direction, guidelines in the law saying, hey, by the way, wink, wink, you can do this if you have a deployed soldier, and it would be better for the family unit in the long run. So with that, members, I'd introduce to you Major Lindsay Olson, Minnesota National Guard.
Representative Lesh, would you like to move the bill first?
I want to, yes. I'd move House File 260, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair. I'm Major Lindsay Olson. I'm here as the chair of the Military and Family Law section of the Minnesota Bar, and I'm also the general counsel for the Minnesota National Guard. I've worked both on the committee that drafted the uniform law itself and also with a working group here in Minnesota and the Family Bar and the MVA. So I have a lot of history with this particular law, so if I can answer any questions you have today. I'd like to just build on what Representative Lesh talked about with some examples, and I want to give two that are a little more in-depth in terms of things we've seen here in Minnesota. The first one involves a service member father who had primary custody of his children, and when he was given notice for deployment, the mother moved for primary custody. And in this particular situation, the mother had had a really unstable environment, had had several abusive relationships, substance abuse problems, some mental health issues, and so hadn't been very involved in the child, with the child at all prior to this time. The father, service member, was remarried and had the wife, the stepmother, had two children as well that the daughter was very close with. And during that period, custody was given to the mother during deployment. And so the child moved with the mother, and the father attempted to move to allow the child to see the stepmother, to keep contact with her and with the step-siblings, and the mother would not allow that. And the court struggled with how legally to allow that continued contact. And in looking at the best interest of the child, what we try to provide during a mobilization or deployed environment would be that for the stability of the child, which is one of the central themes and the best interest factors as well. But this really gets to not just the rights of the service member to have their custody rights, but it really is about the best interest of the child during that time as well, in helping to give guidance, as Representative Lesh said, to the court to help provide that stable environment for the child. The second example that I have is one from a brigade commander friend of mine who I believe you met, Colonel Joe Clyborn. And she was sitting down with a really great soldier who had chosen not to reenlist. And she said to him, I don't understand why you wouldn't reenlist. You've got a great career here. We really want to keep you. You've got a $25,000 bonus on the table. And he said, ma'am, I would love to stay. I've enjoyed serving my country, but during my last deployment, I lost custody of my children because my ex-wife had moved for custody during the deployment, and now I've been relegated to every other weekend rather than the primary custody that I had before. And so he felt that it was a decision between his children and serving his country. So those are two examples of the types of things that we've seen here in Minnesota. Minnesota is currently the only state in the nation that has no protections in this area. So just briefly, I want to be able to get time for your questions, but I want to outline a little bit of what this bill entails. And the first part really lays out and encourages private parties to facilitate their own agreements. Now, anyone who's at all familiar with family law knows that a lot of times that's just not possible. But for people who are amicable, it gives them a way forward. It shows them how to get that agreement drafted and protect the best interests of the child during that period. And the third article has procedures for court orders. So in those cases where parties can't agree, then it will lay out a procedure for a temporary court order during the deployed period that would allow for the child to maintain contact with the service member for certain, and for people in their life who are important to them, and that could be anyone from the grandparents to a step parent to siblings that may not live with the other primary parent. And so there are, amongst that is also expedited hearings for the court. So if a service member has to leave on a short time frame, they're able to get in and get this filed with the court. Article 4 is also very important. It deals with the termination of the agreement and how to reintegrate with the service member parent upon their return. So with that, I would like to allow you to ask any additional questions.
Members, are there any questions for the testifier or for the bill's author? Seeing none, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's going to help a lot of families. And with that, Representative Lesh would renew his motion that House File 260 be passed and referred to the General Register, I believe, correct? Oh, excuse me. I guess it's going to Veterans Affairs. All those in favor of moving the bill to Veterans, passing the bill and moving it to Veterans Affairs, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The bill is on its way to Veterans Affairs. Thank you, Major Olson and Representative Lesh. And folks, with that, our business is finished, and we stand adjourned.
Would you like to change the